Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Looking at our Midwestern state, there are only four where more than 10% of the acreage is left to plant.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA looking at corn planting progress, especially in the Midwest.
Ohio leads that list, 28% left to plant, meaning that they've planted 72% by June 1st. Other states with more than 10% left to plant, Indiana 14% to go, and both Michigan and North Dakota 11% to go. With just a few exceptions, things are winding down on corn planting. Do you want to point out, though, where that cool weather and the wet weather has been a little more persistent? In Ohio, 72% planted. The five-year average there is 87%, so quite a bit behind in the far eastern edge of the Corn Belt.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Why is it important to mitigate it? Well, you know, some risks are so bad that they can cause you financial hardship, or they can take your operation away from you. They can cause your family's hard times. There's a lot of simple things that happen because of risk. And the idea of insurance is, you know, it needs to be affordable, of course, is to cover some of that risk and make sure that it doesn't put you out of business, doesn't create so much trouble in your life that it's earned.
Matt Stockton is a professor and ag economist, University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
And this is why the RMA has gotten into it, and the federal government has decided it's important. It used to be in the old days, what they would do is they would have commodity programs and try to keep prices and support prices and do those sorts of things. But in today's world, they've basically went off and said, okay, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to support world prices. We're not going to have all this problems, and we're going to try and help producers if they want to mitigate risk to be able to subsidize crop insurance. And so when we talk about federal crop insurance and crop insurance programs, these programs are subsidized. That means the federal government says, okay, we'll pay part of it with taxpayer funds, and the rest of it you can bear, so that it's trying to make it more affordable, more usable for you able to be able to use it. That's the whole idea. This is an interesting picture. It's kind of cool. But anyway, common risks you face, and you guys all know what you face, but here's the deal. One thing I noticed when I was first in ag economics was learning about cash flow. And I said, well, what's cash flow? Well, that basically, you know, it's when you get cash, when you don't get cash. In other words, yeah, I got cash flowing in, I got cash flowing out. So when you have a cash flow, you could actually have a situation. I remember where I was working in the construction industry at the time. I was very young. My dad was about to retire. And my brother and I were taking over the business, and he needed a large sum of cash that he removed from the business. And if he removed all of that money, we wouldn't have had any money to actually stay in business. So while we had plenty of contracts and things on the books, we had to pay people salaries. And so cash flow can be very important as far as keeping you in business, because, oh yeah, you got a bunch of cattle out there, but you have no money to feed them, or you have, you know, so the flow of cash is really critical. And that can be one of the risks that you face as a producer. In fact, in agriculture, it's a big risk. And that's why there's things like operation loans and that. But if they have a bad year, like you had borrowed money and then you have a drought and all that kind of stuff, this is where the insurance might be able to mitigate some of the risk of that cash flow. You have a possibility of injury, getting hurt. And then obviously you hear stories where people get cancer or get hurt, and the farms and neighbors are helping out, and they're helping them with their farm. You have labor availability. Some places are isolated. And maybe you have calving or something coming up and all the high school kids are no longer available, or your local guys aren't there, and you're going to have a real struggle maybe getting through calving or that sort of thing. And so there's another risk that you face. Regulatory, you know, rules and laws change, you know, like the riparian things where you have rivers and things, and sometimes the grazing laws have changed for people and they've had to change the way they do things. And that's a risk that you take whenever we're dealing with that sort of thing, and liability and legal issues. We have, of course, the common seasonal price variation. You know, you're looking at the market in the early spring, perhaps it's really good. By the time fall comes around, it's not so good. So there's ways to mitigate that, and some of the insurance programs that we're talking about will cover some of that. And then, of course, there's droughts and catastrophes. And then, obviously, sometimes, you know, you got cattle that are out there and for whatever reason, they just don't do well this year, and your calf weights are down and your costs are up. And so there's a lot of production variation. And these are all risks that livestock producers face.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We take in a dollar, we spent $1.39. This year was supposed to be better. We were only going to spend, $1.36. I mean, it was supposed to get slight, and we have a small problem.
Chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, representative from Arizona, David Schweikert.
With some of the GDP growth numbers, just that adjustment, we may have just lost $200 billion in tax receipts in this fiscal year, you know, into September, between now and then. It just shows you how fragile we are when small movements of interest, you know, when you have to refinance $9 trillion. Thank you for hanging out with us. Welcome back. But think about this. A single point of interest on U.S. debt, and it takes years for it to roll in because of how much we have to refinance. So we'll take about $9 trillion to market this year and refinance. We'll issue a couple trillion new this year. A single point of interest over 10 years costs you $3 trillion. Why does this not scare the crap? Why do we not have people coming behind these microphones, but we're better off getting behind these microphones and telling passionate stories, anecdotes, those things, because that's what gets us on social media. That's what gets people's dopamine hitting. But at some point, the math is going to win. And when we have the really smart analytic firms coming and saying they're scared about U.S. sovereign debt, you see things happening around the world that make me very nervous, the appetite for going on the long end of the curve. Look, United States sells very short-term debt, and then we have 2 years and 5 years and 10 years and 20 years and 30s. But we're having real trouble selling the debt on the long end of the curve. And do not pay attention to some of the debt markets over the last month or two. You want to know why? Because we're in extraordinary measures. We're up against the debt ceiling. We're not issuing new debt. We're only issuing refinance. And what comes due within the cap? What happens a couple months from now when we all raise the debt ceiling? And I love the brain trust that goes, don't raise the debt ceiling. Did I just mention last year for every dollar we took in, we spent $1.39? Just tell me what 39% of the federal spending you want us to stop doing. Because when you don't raise the debt ceiling, we got to end all that. So it's more than a third of all of our spending is functionally borrowed. Just tell me, happy to do it, just tell me which third you want us to stop financing. And those are the very people filling up these hallways demanding we give them more money. What happens when we raise that debt ceiling, Mr. Speaker, and we have to come to market, Treasury has to come to market with $500-600 billion in functionally to catch up, refund all the accounts they've been borrowing from. That's what you do in extraordinary measures. You grab every account, use that cash, now you got to refund it, and you take that much to market. We have one analyst who's saying you will see a pop in U.S. interest rates, maybe on the 10-year hitting 5. Just boom! Because suddenly you're grabbing so much of the world's capital to finance what we've been borrowing internally that now we got to pay back. These aren't surprises. We all know it. But no one reads the damn documents because it's math. And it turns out telling the truth, remember our story here, that fact-based discussions on this floor no longer get you elected, no longer are listened to, no one cares about, just make things up because feelings is now how we make legislation.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Just like agriculture forms a foundation in rural communities, I think science is the base behind that because you have to have the science and technology. And you know, these other countries like China are really pushing forward with their research and development. And so for us to be a leading nation, we need to make sure that we keep our support for research and development on the forefront.
Indiana Representative Dr. Jim Baird, a member of the House Ag Committee.
One example of that is the CHIPS and Science Act at Purdue University. And, you know, Purdue is a very important and an integral part. You know, I'm biased because of Purdue. But anyway, they're an integral part of our agricultural industry in Indiana and across the country. And so I started to talk about the CHIPS and Science Act that has been established at Purdue. And they have a curriculum for teaching students on how to make these chips and so on. And so we have industries that are moving in the research area in around Purdue and West Lafayette that want to get into manufacturing chips and so on. So that takes that supply chain and makes it available to or on board in our country. And I think that is a very helpful situation. We do not need to be overly indebted to some of our adversaries and in these supply chains. And so that is a real plus for the state of Indiana, for Purdue University. And so that goes back to your question about research. And then you have to admire the agribusiness and the research that they do. So you couple that research with the research that's done at the land-grant universities. And then, you know, the United States has 11 basic research labs. And through the coordination between them and the land-grant universities and agribusiness, it's amazing the kind of technology that we have available and the research that we can do. But we probably need to do, we need to emphasize that more, because I think China's outspending us maybe 2-3 to 1. So we need to make sure that we enhance and stay ahead and become a leader in these areas of research and technology and the implementation.
Just 1 year ago, the House Ag Committee was passing a new farm bill, but it never came up for consideration.
I tell people that we have to eat all of that, you know, as you fly over the Midwest and any of the production areas in this country, we have to eat all of that every year. And I use that just to illustrate the point, but the point is we do need trade. And so that's why in the Farm Bill, the market access program, as well as the foreign market development, that's important that we get the producers and our trade representatives to express what we're capable of doing and what we have available and to move these products to move to other countries. And, you know, we were talking about China a minute ago, and I don't want to focus on that except to say that's kind of a double-edged sword. We want to maintain that relationship in terms of trade, because they utilize there are so many people that they utilize a lot of our commodities. And so that's an important part. So that balance between that and what China is trying to do on a global scale is makes it a very challenging situation. So that means to me that we need to make sure we support other market opportunities, whether that be Asia or India or other countries. We need to make sure that we're providing them the appropriate information and the products that we have available, and have a solid interaction with them.
This is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Here today, the May MDM report is being posted to Ag Manager, so it's hot off the press, the latest info.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer.
I alluded to this earlier in my comments and concerns on demand was what gave me pause on the ongoing cattle price increase, and this is a core reason of that hesitation. So the May estimates were consumer demand probably pulled back. So the retail channel, so think grocery store for at home, 6 of the 8 protein sections that we watch here actually had a decline. So consumers were willing to pay less for those items in May than they were in April. And then, as you said, when we look over to the dinner meal, so away from home food service, actually 7 of the 8 meals, we had a decline. So the public is tightening their wallet is the way I would put that. And I'm going to talk about some of that here on the very end of this, but demand pullback in May is what the initial signals are. It's consistent with the protein values estimates that we put out every month in the MDM. The importance of price has grown. So we put out this item, you know, this chart every base report, and which of these 12 items are the most important? So pick 4, which are the 4 that are least important in your protein purchasing decision. And taste and freshness always lead. So no part of this is changing. And it's very common that price is the 3rd most important. That also has not changed, but price has grown in relative importance compared to all the other items, not just this month compared to the past, but it did it in April as well. So basically over the last 60 days, people are getting more price sensitive is the way to think about that. I think that, again, reflects our macroeconomic environment. And to put a bow on that at the very end of the MDM report, one of the things we highlight is financial sentiment. There's a lot of talk in the general media, not just the MDM, much broader, about the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index and how much it has moved and how many concerns there are. Much of that's tied to trade policy uncertainty in the last several months. Well, we asked something very similar, like a subset of those questions we ask in the MDM as well. And in May, only 18% of the public tells us their household finances are better than a year ago. Now, 18%, that's great for them, but that's the minority of the public, right? And that's on par with what the estimates in April were, but that's lower than it was in March and February. So we've had a reduction in sentiment there, right? Fewer people are saying their finances are getting better. And the reason that's important for the meat sector is if you tell me your finances are improving over time, you're much more likely to tell me you had meat in a meal yesterday. And we'll just call out the beef numbers, but I put the same thing out for pork, chicken, and other categories in the report. But for beef, the 18% that said their finances improved, they had 0.85 meals yesterday of beef. Well, extrapolate that out over 7 days, that is basically a 6 meals a week beef approach. So 6 of your 21 meals, you had beef in it. Conversely, the 35% that said my finances are worsening, it's a little over a third of our country, has about 4 meals in the past 7 days that include beef. 4 versus 6 may not sound like a big number, but that difference of 2 times a country of over 300 million, it adds up real quick. We have similar information in there about expenditures. So they also find in the May report, one of the figures I included is your estimated food expenditures at home versus away from home. As your finances are declining, you're telling me you're spending a lot less on food away from home. So the biggest adjustment that occurs, and I've been saying this for months consecutively, it's not a new story, we just continue to see it, is you're spending less on food away from home. And by extrapolation, you're spending less on meat away from home. So the food service channel in particular, right, restaurants et al., faces the biggest challenge from this macroeconomic uncertainty. When you dig a little deeper into this, the public's concerns about unemployment and inflation are quite inflated compared to when we started the year. And I think that's given at least a subset of the public some pause. They definitely want meat protein. I kind of skipped over that for the sake of time here today, but there's more of those details in the MDM. So there's not a lack of desire. People want meat protein, but there's this affordability and what my future finances pessimism looks like that's sort of getting in the road of that. And that's what underlies my choppy waters is my best forecast.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Just tax rich people more.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert is chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee.
We have a report, detailed report, that sort of walks through every tax hike the left has proposed. And look, we're guilty on our side. Every cut we've actually proposed, but you take every tax hike and then you do the economic data on it and you get about 1.5% of GDP. Okay, our cuts come out to about 1% of GDP. If I can do that math, that's 2.5%. Do you remember in the beginning of this? We're borrowing 7.3. So the next time you get a politician say, well, just raise taxes on rich people. And then you show them that it's a fraction of a fraction of what we even borrow every single day. Great rhetorical use of language. Horrible math. Completely fraudulent math. Remember, it's demographics. But we're not allowed to tell people that because it means we as a society have to do hard things. So look, I have this chart here, and I was just trying to make a point. How Washington finances 366 days of spending in 2024. The top 20% of earners covered 201 days. The next quartile down, the next 20%, covered 41 days. The middle earners, so the middle 20%, they paid for 17 days of government spending. The bottom 40% pay for 4 days of government spending. And then 103 days we financed by just borrowing it. We have, I think we are now tied for the most progressive income tax system in the industrialized world. When we modernized the tax code in 2017, the United States income tax system actually became more progressive. But yet, how many times have you heard members around say, well, they gave money to the rich? The rich after 2017 were paying more of the federal income taxes. At some point, we're going to have this really uncomfortable discussion. Is it on the tax side or the spending side? Because I've done entire presentations here on the floor where I've shown you, go back the last 65, 75 years. Here's a time of very high marginal tax rates. We take in about mid-17% of the economy in tax collections. Very low marginal tax rates. We take in about mid-17% of federal taxes. It's sort of, you go up, the actual economy slows down, this is what you take in. So the secret is, how do you adopt regulation and modernize it? How do you adopt tax policy that incentivizes productivity? How do you do the whole thing and get them to interact so you maximize economic growth and that growth becomes your tax collection stability and gets you to the top of the total dollar amounts? But you're probably going to still constantly fall back into that mean of the percentage of the economy. So have a bigger economy. It's not that complicated. But you constantly, you know, so upper income taxpayers overwhelmingly finance the federal government. Okay, I know this isn't good politics. People like me are supposed to say, yeah, the rich need to pay their fair share. Okay, top 25%, excuse me, the top 20% of earners pay 25.2%. The next quartile pays 15.8%. The middle covers 11%. The fourth quartile down, so the next one down, covers 5.5%. Bottom 20% of income earners, we send them money. Remember, we have sort of this negative income tax system, earned income tax credit, those things. So if you're in the 20%, the bottom quartile, we send you money. The bottom 50% pay about 4% of the income tax, but the bottom third actually get money.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think we fundamentally disagree on whether there are cuts to the $30 billion in cuts to SNAP.
Connecticut Representative Johanna Hayes, a member of the House Ag Committee.
There are, in fact, cuts. The cuts just don't start next year or the year after. They begin in 2027. As lawmakers, we must consider the impact of legislation more than 1 year out, especially with legislation as significant as the Farm Bill that makes changes that last five years, 10 years, and sometimes even permanently. We also know that based on the CBO baseline and independent estimates from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the SNAP Thrifty Food Plan cut initially would take away a day's worth of benefits from participants, about $7 a month, and then would rise to almost 2 days worth of benefits, about $15 a month. If the CBO is wrong, I'm willing to give it another look, but that's the information I'm going on. The CBO is saying that there will be $30 billion in cuts to the SNAP program.
And on the anniversary of passing the 2024 Farm Bill, Oklahoma Representative, former chairman of the House Ag Committee, Frank Lucas.
It's hard to believe that it's been 10 years ago since we spent 2.5 years crafting the third generation Farm Bill. And a number of you on the back row were a part of that process, where we had to fight off elements within each caucus, elements within leadership, in order to come up with a comprehensive Farm Bill. And I think it was a pretty amazing product. And the Ag Committee at that point, as it had traditionally been, was so dramatically different than any other committee. Now, think of me as the old uncle. Think of me as the old guy on the wall, whatever you want to think of me as. As the evening has progressed, we have started to sound a little bit like government oversight or judiciary or some of the other committees where everybody likes to fight. That's not the House Agriculture Committee. That's not the House Agriculture Committee. We face challenges just doing our work when we are all working together on this language. I have to assume that everybody is well-intentioned in the primary amendment and the secondary amendment. I understand that. And I'm going to vote in a certain fashion on both. But if this has been against the law since 1938, maybe we need to bring in the Secretary of Labor and the Secretary of Ag and the Director of OSHA and give them a thorough discussion about how they're enforcing existing law. You know, there's folks back home who say you shouldn't pass more laws till you enforce the laws you have. There's some validity to that, my friends. Again, I have the greatest respect for all of you. I've seen this body do some of the most amazing work in the last decade. If we can't craft in this committee and on the floor a comprehensive bill, then I don't know how we ever make it all the way through the process. And one last thought. I know there's some concern here about restricting the authority of various secretaries in the executive branch. But remember, my friends, the next administration may not be this administration. And the people you are leaving more empowered may be people in the future who will use that power in a fashion contrary to what you define as the best interest. I've been around long enough. I'm suspicious of all executive branches. But the only way we fulfill our responsibilities is pulling together. Let's vote and get this over with.
This is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Farmers may think important crop insurance sales closing dates and other significant deadlines have come and gone with the spring crops planted or nearly planted. As former crop insurance agent, now USDA Risk Management Agency Administrator Pat Swanson can attest, there are plenty of dates to keep track of.
I would have a little cheat sheet on my desk that had a little spreadsheet. It would say pasture rain, lunch, and forage. The sales closing date for that is December 1st. And the reporting dates for the other crops, for corn and soybeans, for wheat, for forage seeding, when those crops have to be planted.
Examples, according to the administrator, how date-driven the crop insurance industry is. Sales closing dates and other deadline details, along with information about the federal crop insurance system, are available through local crop insurance agents or online at www.rma.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.